Hello everyone, Rich here for another episode of the Film and Podcast. It's Rich Pickings again. I've got a stack of films in front of me. This time it's documentaries. I've kind of looked through some hidden gems, some favourites. It's a bit of a mix really, but I'm hoping they're all of interest to you if you want to check them out, whether you access them via streaming or DVD, Blu-ray. I'm going to go through them in alphabetical order. So the first one is a really good nature documentary and a bit of a tour, really, of parts of the world in search of a very infamous creature. One of the first times, if not the first time, it was filmed as well on camera. It's Blue Water White Death. And this was one of the main inspirations behind Jaws. So Peter Benchley obviously saw this film at the cinema. And yeah, it kind of pushed him towards obviously writing the book and researching great white sharks. For better, for worse, what happened later on with the culling of these creatures. Well, that's another story. But I think it's well worth checking out. It's a documentary that grew in notoriety in my household because it's one of those films that I recall my dad talking about when I was growing up. And I didn't actually get to see it probably until about 15 years ago. So it was, it was something that obviously was quite difficult to pick up. I mean, obviously when DVD came out, you could get it on import. It basically tells the story of director Peter R. Gimble and his associate director James Lipscomb make a film where they're basically looking for the infamous great white shark. So about 12,000 miles they travel, and it's filmed over a 6-month period, and they visit South Africa, they go via Madagascar, Australia, anywhere where they can find footage of the great white. And the footage is shot or assisted by Ron and Valerie Taylor, who basically help the camera crew in locating the great white. So Ron and Valerie Taylor, for those of you who don't know, obviously they're behind the real life footage that you see within Jaws, specifically towards the end where it's caught up in the cage. And yeah, there's kind of elements of it that are sort of reminiscent again of this documentary. So well worth checking out. It was originally released in 1971, if I recall. So it's pretty old, but it holds up. It's interesting, and it's, you know, it's good to see people that are both passionate about what they're into and complete crazy bastards as well, that obviously are not put their lives in other people's hands, let's put it that way. Next up is a documentary from Dog Wolf. And I think this is the only one in the list I've got from Dog Wolf. Though, I mean, you could literally do a Rich Pickings just on their label. It's a fantastic label full of amazing documentaries. And you can buy them on DVD and Blu-ray. You can get them via streaming as well. And this is one called Fear of 13, or The Fear of 13. And wow, what can I say about this? It absolutely blew me away. I would probably say this is in my top three documentaries of all time. And it essentially tells the story of a man on death row. And he's a prisoner who makes a final appeal. And he doesn't demand freedom, but he demands his own execution. But as he tells the story, and this is how the whole documentary pans out, is literally just, talking heads. He goes through what happened to him and how he got, you know, how he was in prison. And it gradually becomes clear that nothing is quite what it seems when you're listening to the story unfold. And it really does play out like a psychological thriller. And this man is clearly in search of some redemption. And there's so many twists. There's twists and turns in this documentary that are up there with any movie you would watch. And the final revelation at the end is incredible. It's really moving. It isn't what you expect it to be, which I think is what makes it all the more surprising. And I cannot recommend it highly enough. That's The Fear of 13 on a Dogwolf label. And it's fairly recent. Let's have a look on here. What is it? 2015. So it's five years ago. So yeah, check it out. Next up, we have a brilliant documentary I picked up about a month ago. And this is about the Disney animators, Ollie Johnston and Frank Thomas. It's called Frank and Ollie. And it's a real cozy little insight into, you know, two old timers and their career as Walt Disney animators. And it primarily focuses on them. It shows you their drawing style. It shows you how they animate. It shows you their personality, and more importantly, how the personality comes through into their work. And they're just two old guys that, you know, have loved what they do. And they've known each other. They knew each other for years, 50, 60 years even. And they lived next door to each other. And the wives knew each other. And the children grew up together. And the pets played with each other. And it's just such a beautiful thing to watch. It is almost an animated film in itself, in the sense that you could imagine Disney latching onto the sentimentality of it. But yeah, it's just wonderful, wonderful. And if you're a big animation fan like myself, and you appreciate Disney, then this is well worth checking out. You can really get a feel of their characters coming through into the animation when it shows you clips and the way they move and the way that they reference themselves. Just striking. And, you know, if you had half the talent in your little fingernail than these two have, then, you know, you would be set up for life. They're amazing, amazing, amazing artists. Next up is a documentary I tend to show my students, actually, and it's a good one to show about product placement. It's a fun watch, as you would expect, by Norman Spurlock. It's The Greatest Movie Ever Sold, and this is essentially a documentary that takes you through how product placement and what some people are starting to call branded entertainment now, and how that's evolving or has evolved even since this documentary, and how that sells a film. And what Spurlock does, he is ironically uses the very film he's making to interview companies about their products, in then order to place the product in his documentary film, which then starts to fund it. So there's this kind of almost sort of meta quality about the documentary. It's fun, and it's a really easy watch, and it's immensely entertaining. You learn something from it. You really do get to see an insight into that part of how a film is sold. And yeah, some of it it makes you a little cynical, but you can kind of see how these things happen. I mean, this is from 2011, so it's nearly a decade old. A lot has happened in a decade, and even the way things are advertised now. So it'd be interesting to see if he makes a follow-up, because, you know, obviously with Super Size Me, he's kind of returned to that. He's probably kind of looking over some of his material and seeing how, you know, a lot of the things he's documenting have changed over the years. So that would be an interesting one to keep an eye out on. So The Greatest Movie Ever Sold, check it out. Next up, this one is going to sound completely dull and boring to most people, but I guarantee you now that this is an incredible documentary. And it's one of the ones I put at the top of my pile for my graphic design students, even though a lot of them watch it and they get through it and they really just don't click with it, which is either a loss to them or makes me a bad tutor. But in learning about a typeface, this documentary is absolutely the documentary you need to watch. There are not a lot of documentaries about typefaces, funnily enough, but this is the one. It's called Helvetica, and it's by Gary Hustwit, and he's done a trilogy of these films. I think one was on, I think it might have just been called Object, and it's about product design. He's done another one on architecture since as well. All worth checking out, but Helvetica is a really interesting watch, and it goes into the use of that font, how it is a universal font that communicates to all. But the interesting thing about it is it's split into two main sections, and then there's kind of a bit at the end as well, which is a kind of more sort of balanced argument about it. But the first part is those that appreciate Helvetica and the history of it, and then you have those communicating how they don't like Helvetica and how, you know, it's dull, and in using a font that is so stripped back limits the imagination and distills ideas so much that then it makes things, you know, it doesn't particularly make for an imaginative outcome. For example, if you looked at the work of someone like David Carson, who is the epitome of what Helvetica stands for, then you would kind of understand that, because David Carson's work is very experimental, and, you know, it's kind of more influenced by him just putting music on and reacting to music and building it straight on the computer. Whereas other graphic designers and typographers are, you know, very precise in how they work with it. And it's important to them to communicate a message very, very clearly. So do check Helvetica out. Trust me, it's not boring. It's a really, really good documentary. And if you want to learn about typefaces and, you know, how to communicate to people very, very, very clearly through graphic design and signage, I think you will leave the house once the coronavirus has gone, and you'll look at all of those shops out there and signs and motorway signs and realize that, so this font is actually embedded within society more than you realize. I don't know, maybe it's a Big Brother thing. The Imposter is up next. One of my favorite documentaries of all time. Again, this would be in my top three. Wow, it plays out like a thriller. I think a lot of people would have watched this. It's a documentary from 2012, if I recall. Tells the story of an individual who in 1994 assumes the identity of a 13-year-old boy by the name of Nicholas Barclay, who disappears from his home in Texas. Obviously the family are distraught. 3 years pass and he is found in Spain, apparently, but he's disorientated and he doesn't really know who he is. And this person they bring back is then, he kind of works his way into the family. So I'll tell you up front, it's not a spoiler, because you find out quite early on anyway. It turns out that this person that is assuming the identity of their son isn't just kind of making out he's someone else. He starts to do more insidious things as well, which I'm not going to spoil for you. And like I said, it's one twist after the next. You kind of think, well, where is this going? You know, why is he working his way into this home? How come none of the family members are questioning this as much as they should be? In hindsight, the documentary is structured with interviews of the family and the imposter, and you start to kind of then, you know, understand why he's doing this, what sort of background is from, has it happened before, etc., etc. But it's a superb, superb documentary, well worth checking out. Next up, we have a documentary that you can only get on import, so apologies for that. It's on Blu-ray. If you've got a multi-region player, absolutely check it out. If you can find it via maybe Amazon or somewhere like that on streaming, you may be able to find it on there too. This is Jodorowsky's Dune, and wow, this a documentary basically that is about the one of the greatest films never made. Who wouldn't want to see Jodorowsky adapt Frank Herbert's Dune? Utterly bonkers. Utterly bonkers, trust me. When you watch this documentary, some of the stories and how Jodorowsky talks through his ideas and where he wanted to take it, bearing in mind it got to a point where you're not entirely convinced he was even reading the novel or understanding the novel. It just kind of evolved into something else entirely. The ambition and where he was taking this and who he was bringing on board. You know, Salvador Dali, he wanted the music of Pink Floyd in there. Obviously, H.R. Geiger and Dan O'Bannon were involved as well, which then kind of led to a lot of these people, including Jean Giraud, a.k.a. Mobius, also kind of then working on Ridley Scott's Alien. So even though this kind of all fell through, it gave birth to something else. A lot of these creatives and the creative talent that had kind of, you know, spent time in Paris working on this project, then used a lot of that to a lot of the skills they learned to develop ideas for the xenomorph in Ridley Scott's Alien. So there's, you know, there's a lot of interviews in there as well. We've got H.R. Geiger's interview, Gary Kurtz, the producer of Star Wars, Nicholas Winding Refn as well. He's kind of touches upon on the film. It's legendary, really. I mean, people, you know, before the age of the internet, especially during the 1970s, this would have been something almost mythic in hearing about. So you can kind of only really imagine what this would have been like to hear about this film only based on what you would have seen of Jodorowsky's work, which is, you know, completely nuts if you've ever watched El Topo or Holy Mountain or Santa Sangre. You know, they are, you know, beautiful films, real mix of kind of exploitation and art house cinema. And, you know, all led, all written by and directed by somebody who is an interesting character. You know, he's fairly, well, I say fairly egotistical. He is, he's got a very big ego, and he kind of has a unfiltered, almost unrivaled imagination. It just kind of pours out of him. And his comic book work is just as good, if not, I personally prefer his comic book work to his films. And I think if you read something like The Meta Barons, it's interesting to read that after Dune fell through, because I think a lot of the concepts and the epic scope of all of that was kind of developed further for, you know, that series of comic books. So definitely check out Meta Barons after you watch the documentary. Next up, again, another favourite. Again, I think a lot of you have probably seen this. If you haven't, you must check it out. I've mentioned this a few times on Mondo Movie House. It's Lost Soul, the doomed journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau. Completely irrelevant for at the minute after the recent release of Colour Out of Space. This was the film that literally sent Stanley into the wilderness years. Like, for the last 20 years, he's literally just been a recluse. And it's only from people kind of, you know, interviewing him and, you know, kind of, you know, searching for him, for looking for where he's at now and where his mind's at, and nurturing and encouraging him to come back and make another film. But this pretty much broke the man. And if you've never heard Richard Stanley talk about his life and his filmmaking, you cannot make it up. You would think he is completely, he's either on another spectrum entirely, or he is the most convincing actor you will ever come across. But he is fascinating, absolutely fascinating in the way he tells his stories. Anything from curing his mother of cancer by injecting her eyes with meteorite blood to, you know, drug running for Dario Argento to ending up in Afghanistan, you name it, you wouldn't believe it. And he articulates himself incredibly well, and he's just fascinating to listen to. I would listen to him all day. He's an amazing, amazing individual and very inspiring. Even if you didn't connect with his films per se, I think you would get something out of listening to him. He's an absolutely fascinating character. So yeah, definitely check that out. It's bonkers. It goes through the whole production process from where he's booted off to stories of Marlon Brando coming on set and troubles with Val Kilmer, the special effects, where they were filming it. It goes into so much detail, even to the point where Richard Stanley, he, to not spoil too much for you, he doesn't actually leave. He's sacked and he's thrown off set, but he doesn't leave. He stays on the island and wandering around the local habitat, surviving off the land almost, if you believe that. But yeah, it's really interesting, and I don't want to spoil too much more, but if you have not seen it, definitely check it out. Next up, we have Nightmares in Red, White and Blue. I think this is it's certainly my favourite horror documentary. It's on import. You have the likes of John Carpenter, Mick Garris, Joe Dante, Larry Cohen, George A. Romero, Roger Corman, Brian Usner. All of them are on this. They're all talking exclusively for the documentary. It's a fascinating insight into the killing of America. It's a fascinating insight into a core part of American history, the Vietnam War, how that impacted on, you know, modern American horror. And it covers a multitude of films. You have obviously Psycho. You've got Rosemary's Baby in there. It looks at the old Universal classics. It makes parallels between those films and modern horror from the slasher. You know, you look at Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's all in there. It's a really, really good documentary. And the thing that elevates it that little bit more as well, it's narrated by Lance Henriksen. Who doesn't like Lance Henriksen? It's brilliant. It's so much in there. Yeah, all the way up to basically like post 9/11. It discusses, like, you know, subjects like xenophobia. It makes a lot of comparisons and studies of, you know, that time in America, which is incredibly important. So yeah, definitely check out Nightmares in Red, White and Blue. You may be able to find it on YouTube. I think it was on there at one point, but if not, definitely worth investing in. And finally, the last documentary I'm going to recommend is one called Precinct 75. And this is essentially a documentary about a corrupt policeman in the 80s and 90s. And it begins in Brooklyn precinct known as the 75 in the late 80s. And essentially, it kind of tells the story of New York being this murder capital as well. And sort of ground zero for, you know, the crack cocaine epidemic. So you can really get a picture of New York being a completely different place back then, in complete contrast to what it's like now. You know, extremely volatile. You get a real sense of the grime, and you know, you watch TV series that come out, you get a sense of that anyway. But this is real, and it's really that one guy, one policeman, who basically led his crew on a rampage through East New York, and he would basically rob drug dealers at gunpoint. He stole kilos of cocaine, hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash. This officer, Michael Dowd, is a piece of work. He's even interviewed throughout the documentary, and he's the ego and you know, his personality and everything. You'd think he would have learned some humility. Nope, not at all. He was arrested back in 92, and it led to basically the largest police corruption scandal in the history of New York. And yeah, it basically focuses on his story, but it's very much a snapshot of a particular time period. And you know, if you've seen films like Copland, you can kind of see what it's pulling, you know, some of the stories from. But this, it's brilliant. It's really, really good. So if you've not seen it, definitely check it out. I mean, even on the cover it says the cop version of Goodfellas. I mean, sold. Yeah, really good, really good. So that's it. That's this episode all on documentaries, and I'm pretty sure I could do another one just on documentaries. There's a lot I've got on the shelf which I love, and I often dig out and watch again. Nightmares in Red, White and Blue, particularly because of the book I've been writing. But really good, all recommended. If you could head on over to iTunes, put a rating, put a review, any of that will really help. You can follow me at Rich Pieces on Twitter. You can follow the podcast at Film and Podcast across at least Instagram and Twitter as well. And why not message me, email me if you want to join the Facebook group, and we'll add you personally. That's it for now. See you next time.
That's just a sample of the films to come. You can't please all the people all the time, but we hope we'll please most of you most of the time. Anyway, see you soon.